The Public Relations Society of America's 2001 International Conference presents this live presentation recorded for PRSA in Atlanta, Georgia in October of 2001. If you're listening to the audio tape format, at the end of Side 1, please stop the tape and turn to Side 2 for the conclusion of this presentation.
Wagner now. And for years, when Pat gave his talk at this conference, I don't know for how many years, 40, something, whatever, he always complained about the room not being big enough. And you'd think that they'd learn. And now that I'm on the board, you'd think I'd learn, so we'll make sure that we continue to have room. Anyway, it's nice to have you with us. And as I mentioned also there, that the firm is going on, and the principals are all here today with you. And I just wanted to introduce, to start off, who will be the moderator of our program today, Pat McGee. Pat is the new Chief Executive Officer of Jackson, Jackson & Wagner. Pat worked together for years, and he knew all the people at Jackson, Jackson & Wagner. Pat McGee did. He did some work with them over the years. Had spent a lot of time with Pat, and was somebody that we felt would be a real integral part of our team to continue to keep this team going forward. So Pat will take over, and nice to have you with us, and let's go.
Okay, thank you, Michael. Well, welcome, everyone. We may be getting some more chairs, so if we do, we'll just bring them in and try to make yourself comfortable. I think those of us who were at the Legends lunch today and saw the videotape had an insight into Pat's view, as we could call it, of public relations, but even more than that, his feeling that this is a philosophy, this is a way of life for us in public relations. And so what Pat has taught us through the years is now being kept going and moving forward through our organization. And so for the last 45 years, Jackson, Jackson & Wagner has really been driven by a passion for public relations and a deep, deep desire to be able to achieve specific desired outcomes and behaviors and measurable results. And this passion in the firm, led by Pat Jackson, brought the firm to a point where we are a behavioral public relations and management consulting firm. That's what we describe ourselves as, behavioral public relations and management. And that really means our behavioral approach has a number of elements that are important to us, and I think important to all of us in public relations. First of all, it's based on the seminal communications theories that we have. And Stacy is going to be addressing that in a few minutes. Secondly, it's supported by decades of research on how and why individuals behave the way they do, and how and why organizations behave the way they do. And the third thing that goes into our behavioral approach is the experience that we've gained from many, many years of working with clients throughout the nation, throughout the country, from companies in the top 10, the Fortune 500, down to local nonprofit groups in our own community. So that desire and passion in public relations is what made Jackson, Jackson, Wagner, and Pat Jackson push and push and push the envelope of public relations. And if we didn't believe that achieving behavior change was important before, I think we really have to look at our world today. And we see three forces that are coming together just as we meet today that make our approach, what we all agree would be the behavioral approach to public relations, more important than ever. The first that we see is we're living in uncertain times. This was brought home on September 11th. I think you'll hear a lot of reference to that during our conference here in Atlanta. But September 11th changed our world, changed our view of reality. We are now altered country. And what does that mean for us as practitioners, these uncertain times? First of all, we look at people, we look at strangers with a little more distrust perhaps than we did before. We examine our own institutions. And I think what you heard Pat talking about today, about trust and relationship, goes right at the core of these uncertain times. Today, what do we see happening in our organizations? We see visitors centers being closed. We see limited access to our physical plants. We see a restriction on the flow of information. Web pages that are taken down, web pages that are restricted. Email protocols that says you can't open any attachments. How about our regular mail? What happens now? Any package that's suspect, that's a little odd shape, that looks different, doesn't have a return address on, doesn't have the right shape, or we don't know the sender, gets discarded. We have situations where senior management are prohibited from going out in the public. All these things attack our sense of trust and what we know we need to achieve as public relations professionals, relationships. So uncertain times are affecting our ability to maintain relationships with those publics that are critical. The second force, and our speaker addressed it today, is this world or global economy. And what does that mean? Well, we have global companies working around the world, so we may be working for someone who's not just a local company before. Therefore, we have global reactions to things, and we have global cause and effect. Something that happens on the other side of the world that we might have a few years ago considered a small incidental thing can have major repercussions on our own organizations in the matter of minutes or hours because of the way we're wired together today. So that means as public relations practitioners, we have to be even better at identifying trends, anticipating issues, and then coming back to our organizations and say, here are some strategic things you can do to deal in this world and global economy. And the third force, and again, it was coincidental that our speaker this morning address this, is the increasing use of technology in our organizations. The pace that this is going on, as we know, is accelerating, but what does it mean to us as practitioners? Well, first of all, it means that every single structure within the organization is being realigned because of technology. It means that some of the old relationships that we have are now changing. It means that if we can't show our value to a corporation, to our organization, to our clients, to our institutions, and how we fit with this new streamlined organization, we run the risk of being marginalized and put aside. We have to be part of this process. We have to understand technology and what it's doing and how it's changing our organizations. And I know we've been talking about this for years, but how public relations impacts the bottom line, and we can only pack so much into our session today, but if you haven't seen the 9 ways that public relations impacts the bottom line, and we're going to be telling this all day, put it on the back of your business card, 9 ways, we'll send it out to you. We can't have everything here today. But these three forces, living in uncertain times, the global and world economy, and technology are all coming together at one time, which means our role as practitioners is probably more important than ever before. And if we can't get beyond thinking that what we're about is activities and not results, we're not going to be the type of practitioners that Pat Jackson talked about or the ones that our world needs today. So what we want to do today is present an overview of the behavioral model that Pat Jackson and others have developed over the years, and that's in your information, and all the models that we're presenting today will be distributed to you, so you'll be able to take notes on them. So Pat and other leading minds in the field of public relations developed the behavioral model. So we're going to present that. We're also going to give you 6 applications of that. How you can take this behavioral model and immediately start to use it with your own organizations and your own institutions and clients. Also, as we go through that, we'll also have the ability to talk with each other. So what we've set up for today is a presentation that begins with the behavioral model and the applications of it. We're going to have a presentation on each of those 6 boxes. And after those, the presentation will consist of a few minutes of theory on what it's all about. And then we're going to have a few minutes of application and a case study so you see how it actually works. And then we're going to turn it back to you. We're going to break into our small groups here. Each table has a moderator. We're going to ask you to address something from your own experience on one of these boxes in the models so you begin to learn a little bit more. And this is really, why do we do this? For a couple reasons. First of all, we know, and it's not news to you, but we've studied it and we know how people learn, that it's if we get people to see it, to hear it, to immediately talk about it, to write it down, that we've ingrained a lot of learning in that one session. And secondly, we thought it was important to get a room full of professionals like this that you can actually share some information with yourselves. So that's why we selected to do the small groups. And as many of you might have noticed on the program, this is a double session. So the first part of the session, we're going to cover the model and one of the applications, two of the applications. In the second half, we're going to cover the other three applications. Now, we will take a break at 3:45. We encourage you to stay. You'll get the most benefit out of you if you can stay for the whole presentation. So we really encourage you. We'll all be here. If you have questions, just come up and see one of us, and we'll try to answer some of those questions. If you have comments, we'd love to hear what you're thinking. So also during the presentation, as I did before, we're going to mention things that we couldn't kind of cram into this today. Even though we have a double session, there's a lot of material to cover. So we'll say, you know, if you want something, put it on your business card, and we'll get it to you. And we'll come back to our office, and we'll send you out some information on whatever topic you're interested in. So just jot those down. At the end, we'll collect the business cards. And finally, during our presentations today, you're going to hear us name some clients in our case studies. Something that's quite unusual for us. We have a very strict confidentiality clause with our clients. We don't list our clients on our website. We don't hand out copies of our clients. We don't publicize ourselves to our clients. We have a special relationship. Every client that we mention today, we have expressed permission to use them in the case studies. Sometimes we just refer to them in company, but refer to them by name. Please know that we have permission to do that. So what I'd like to do is just introduce the people who will be helping to moderate our panel today. They were sitting at the tables, but we asked most of them to get up so you could have a seat. And I'll try to find them in the room. First of all, Isabel Park, who's with the firm. I'll give a little more detailed introduction as they begin their presentation. Gail Winslow Pine, Robin Schell, Roger Stevenson, Lois Sekarek Hogan, who am I missing? Michael Jackson is up here. Have I missed someone that I... And Stacy, who I'm going to introduce fully at this moment. So at this time, I would like to introduce Stacy Smith, APR. Stacy is senior counsel with Jackson Jackson Wagner. When she stands up, don't be shocked. She's been with the firm 21 years. I think we violated child labor laws when she first started there. But Stacy is senior counsel. So in addition to working with and offering senior level advice to our clients around the country, Stacy is also intricately involved in Dudley Research, which is our behaviorally focused research arm at JJ&W. Stacy is really terrific at, first of all, scoping out what the client needs, what the data needs are, designing the instruments, and then interpreting the data and giving it back to the client in a way that, one, it's understandable, two, that it's manageable, that you can work with it, and most importantly, three, that it's actionable, it's behaviorally focused and behaviorally implementable. So at this point, I'll have Stacy Smith, and Stacy's going to walk us through the real meat of this presentation today.
Good afternoon. Can you all hear me? Is this good? All set in the back? Can't hear? Okay, just a minute. I'll get there. How's that? Better? I'll talk loud anyway. Pat was right. A lot of things in this world are changing. Rapidly, and we don't know quite where they're heading. But there are some things that are not changing, some things that are remaining very much the same, and that is pretty much how people make decisions that affect their lives. This is a model that has pretty much been intact, as our speaker this morning was talking about the 1200s and 900s. If you thought about the behavioral pattern of what was going on at that time, things are staying the same, how people make those decisions. What is changing, however, is what we're learning about how people make decisions. We're learning more and more as time goes on. There's more research being done, there's more studies, there's more applications, and we're documenting it further. And what I'm going to present to you first here is basically the new generation behavioral public relations model, the next step away from diffusion or beyond diffusion, that really explains to us how people are making decisions that affect our lives, their lives, and our organization's lives. Now, well, is this the on button? That's the on button. All right, we have it both here on overhead and here on a board, and this will stay up obviously through the whole time. Before I begin, how many of you have heard Pat Jackson present the behavioral model? Oh boy, I got some fun in front of me. Okay, well, you can keep me on the straight and narrow. If I miss it, just, you know, throw it out, but we'll see. The behavioral model starts with awareness, starts in the awareness box. Obviously, we can accomplish nothing unless people are aware of what it is that we need to communicate, whether it's an issue, a product, a service, whatever it is, we need awareness. Awareness needs to be built. Without awareness, we're not going anywhere. What happens when people gain awareness is, as Pat Jackson always said, an IBM file opens in their head. A little file opens up, and then all the awareness and information from diffusion starts to build and fills up the file. We've taken this information, here it comes, we're starting to collect it in our head. The question becomes, in terms of behavior, does awareness lead to the ultimate desired behavior? And rarely, if ever, does it. So when we talk about the median, I think that's why he always focused on the median not being the be-all and end-all. This is pretty much why, because you can communicate in community and get that message in the media, and what it does is it builds incredible awareness, and that's important. But it's not what's going to stimulate the ultimate desired behavior. So we have to look at what else is in the process. We build awareness, and what happens next in the process of behavior change is what we call latent readiness, the building of latent readiness. Now, the best way I can describe this to you is the file, the IBM file in the head is for the information. There are IBM files in the heart and in the gut, those intuitive things that Pat talked about that start to fill with other kinds of information, other kinds of connections that occur about whatever it is that we are connecting with them about. There's a circle around the latent readiness. It's critical to latent. Let me back up and explain what latent readiness is. It's a predisposition to act in a particular way. It's the gathering of feelings, emotions, all the pieces that kind of really push you to where you want to go. So all that other emotional piece. If you understand Maslow's hierarchy of needs, all that thing comes into it. And if you don't have Maslow's in your drawer and you need it, write it on his card. And we'll get it to you, put it under the nine ways. All those pieces of emotion that cause behavior to happen in terms of latent readiness. Now, the R around latent readiness stands for relationships. Relationships are critical in building latent readiness because that's where much of the information and social input comes when we build latent readiness. It's the friends, it's the family, it's the organizational family, all putting these things in to try and build a sense, a predisposition to behave in a certain way, or to not behave, or to let our organizations behave. So that's what latent readiness does in the behavioral model. Now, we can build great latent readiness. Will that give us our ultimate desired behavior? Not often. Sometimes it will do that, but not often. What we really need for latent readiness to work is something very critical, very important to the model, which is called triggering events. Now, triggering events are events that occur. They can be manufactured by us. They can be naturally occurring. They can be manufactured or naturally occurring outside of our organization. A naturally occurring triggering event that's occurring outside all of our organizations just this weekend was changing the clocks back. A natural event in the life cycle of our lives and our society that we, some organizations, have used to use that triggering event, go change your smoke detectors. So when you get home, make sure you change your smoke detectors. We all know that now. That's something. That's a naturally occurring triggering event. A manufactured event that an organization can create is like a sale, something as simple as a sale. It's a triggering event to stimulate the behavior of your target audience, of that individual at some point in time. So triggering events are key, but you have to understand triggering events occur, stimulate behavior on what we call a continuum. You do not have a triggering event move you from no behavior all the way to the ultimate desired behavior. What happens is triggering events take you on like a little leapfrog all the way along. And what the beauty of that process and how nice it is that we can use those little leapfrog events for measurement of how we are doing in terms of moving behavior along the continuum. We don't want to sit here with everybody with no behavior on this end, and the school bond comes, and we're going to need them to vote, and we have no idea when the triggering event of Election Day comes whether they're going to show up and vote for us. We need things along the way, like them asking for information about it, or reading the material, or talking to the person who knocks on the door, or giving some money, or volunteering their time. Little triggering events that we can actually track along the way to see that, yes, we're moving people. Things are happening. So triggering events are key. And the preparatory and or intermediate behaviors before the ultimate desired behavior is also key. But there's something more important, something very important in this, because yes, you can do triggering events, you've built your awareness, all the latent readiness is built up, we've got the triggering events going, but there's one key piece that makes it much smoother and much more effective, and that is the piece about relationship building. We need to have the relationships built so that when triggering events occur, not only do they have the information and knowledge and the reward of people around them, surrounding them, saying, yes, this is the steps you need to take, but they also have the reinforcement of that. So couple your relationships with your triggering events, once you've built your awareness and built up the latent readiness, and your, this is how it moves. And if you think about your own situation, your own life, don't even worry about work, just your own life, you'll see how this works. Let's take a topic as simple as our health. And that will include taking care of yourself, eating right, getting to sleep, exercising 3 days a week, being at your optimal weight. All right, we all have IBM files on this, don't we? And they are cram full. We know 30% of our diet should be fat, 30 minutes of walking or whatever it is a week. We've got it. We even probably have latent readiness around it. The information that we see all the time, the buildup of people who have gotten ill around us, things happening, our latent readiness is probably filled. Those files through our intuition, everything, are just totally built up. How many of you actually do anything about it? All right, we got a couple of innovators here. They can leave the room. No, but look at the majority of us. You know, we know this stuff, but are we behaving? I know I'm not. What we need often, and what does cause you to actually behave? What causes you actually to get on the bandwagon and watch what you're eating and maybe go walking, and it may last a month? Somebody has a heart attack. A wedding comes up. It's college, high school reunion. A triggering event occurs that causes us to do the behavior that we know that has been built in terms of our awareness and our latent readiness to do it. And the triggering event comes, and we do it. But do we do it continuously? No, we need that reinforcement. We need to, the ultimate desired behavior is a very tough one on health to get to. An example I read about last week is the American Heart Association put together this program to get women or people to exercise, and it's on the web. And what you're supposed to do is you sign up and you put in your goal weight and how many times you're going to walk and how many times you do that, and then you're supposed to go do it and come back and enter all the information. And they were so good at building awareness, and the latent readiness was so built in those people that 23,000 people signed up for this program. 23,000 people, they were that effective in getting the awareness and getting people started. But you know what happened? The triggering event was the program that got them going. When they did the measurement 6 months later to see how many people were still with it, 3,000 people were all that completed the program. What happened was in the design of that particular program is they left out a very critical piece. They left out the relationship piece. Because unlike Weight Watchers, or AA, or NA, or any of those programs where we come together in groups and we support each other, that wasn't part of the program. It was a very individual thing. So they made it. They almost made it. They got all the way through, but they left out the relationship piece. And the program subsequently didn't make it. So now you see pretty much how the model works. So then the next question is, how do you do it? How do you apply it in your everyday work? Well, We have a system that we have been using that helps us apply the model in our work, and this is what we want to share with you today. A system that is basically cyclical. It's a system that continues to go. It's over here, and it's in your folders. The handout's in your folders if you want to take notes on it. This is what we're going to talk about today. It's a system that basically super targets. We know we cannot deal with everybody that's out there that we need to reach. We need to find our key stakeholders, really narrow it down, find the people who can give us the behaviors we want, and super target them. The super targeting really focuses on the piece of the behavior model of awareness. Because you can, building awareness to a huge group of people, you will miss a ton. The farther down you super target the people you need, the better you can target what you're going to do in terms of building awareness. You can speak directly to them. It's a program that focuses on behaviors. We go to key stakeholders for desired behaviors. We want to know what it is, the behaviors that we want, both ultimate and intermediate, triggering along the way. And that takes in all the latent readiness. We need to understand, in terms of designing behaviors, what are going to be the barriers that are going to keep them from doing those behaviors that we're talking about. What are going to be the affinities? What is out there that's going to encourage them and help them? And the more we understand latent readiness, the more we can design desired behaviors that are more on target. So we go direct to key stakeholders for desired behaviors via opinion leaders. This is about influentials. This is about relationships. This is where your relationship piece comes, because unless we have the people out there doing the work on our behalf, it's not the media that's going to do it. The relationships are people to people, face to face kinds of things. So we need the opinion leaders. We use the organizational family, the other half of the relationship equation. That's the other piece. These are the people who have to believe in us, who have to agree with what's going on in our organization, who have to support it. And if they're not on board, then we lose a whole group, big group of influentials around whatever the program is and whatever the desired behaviors we're trying to achieve. And finally, we have to localize everything. Everything needs to come down to where I live, what's important to me, whatever we're talking about and whatever we're trying to achieve, how it affects my life. Because if it doesn't affect my life, I'm not going to do squat about it. And we know that. You know, it's really got to come down to that. The beauty of a cyclical model is that it does our evaluation. It forces our evaluation. Because once we're down to localizing everything, we look at our behaviors. Are we getting them? Aren't we? Are our immediate behaviors coming? And we can refocus and we can redefine. Are we in the right stakeholder group? Are we looking for the right behaviors? Do we have the right opinion leaders? Are our organizational family on board? And are we localizing things? So it's a cyclical process. And as you go through the process, you can take all these pieces of the behavioral model, connect with it. Okay? Got it? All right. What we're going to do now is I'm going to turn it back to Pat to introduce our next people who are going to be talking about the key box on going direct to key stakeholders.
All right, thank you, Stacy. Our next two presenters will be talking about going direct to key stakeholders. And first we have Isabel Park. Isabel's APR fellow, PRSA. She's senior counsel and president at Jackson, Jackson & Wagner. Been with the firm since the early days and is recognized from clients from coast to coast working with them. Isabel has deep experience in environmental and forest issues, certainly well known in the private educational institutions, and does a lot of work on issue anticipation. Roger Stevenson is counsel at JJ&W since 1999. He has a strong background in government affairs and public affairs. He works with associations, environmental groups, does a lot of coalition building, grassroots work, and issue work, as well as media management. So at this time, we'll turn it over to Isabel, followed by Roger.
I'm going to talk about going direct to your stakeholders. Now, probably this is a mantra you can already repeat. We all know, to some extent, you go direct your stakeholders. But this is the basic component of the behavioral model. And I'll basically define the concept, and then Roger will introduce the process in action. All right, let's refresh our minds as to why we go direct to our stakeholders. It's two reasons. First, you want to establish your organization as their primary and most credible source of information. And secondly, you want your organizations to buy into your agenda. And you want this to happen before the media or others frame the issue and drive the outcome. And in this situation, primacy usually beats recency. But the problem is, how many of us, particularly in this day and age of budget cutting, have the time or the resources to communicate directly? And this means two-way communication, one-on-one. How many of us have this time to get in touch directly with all our stakeholders in this particular issue? Yeah, I see you're nodding your head. You can't. So what do you do? How do we focus our energy? And the answer is, it's a two-way communication strategy. The first step, you identify the small number of open-minded opinion leaders that are willing to discuss with you, willing to discuss your position, and are also willing to talk about it with their peers. How many opinion leaders are likely to be in this select group? Do any of you know Leslie's paradigm? Okay. It all goes on. If you look at this slide, what you want to concentrate is the 8% in the middle. Use your resources to super target this group. And one by one, to get support from as many of them as you possibly can for your agenda. Because a leadership endorsement from this 8% can be the triggering event, to go back to triggering events, that can pull the 45 who have an opinion and won't do anything about it to an intermediate behavior, and there we have the intermediate behavior of moving from pure awareness to latent readiness. And if you aren't sure how you're going to identify these crucial 8%, Robin Shell will lay it all out for you in the next segment of the presentation. So identifying this 8% is the first step of going direct to your stakeholders. What's the second step? It's known as preaching to the choir. Now, sometimes we're told preaching to the choir is a waste of time. But in this particular situation, it isn't. But you need to preach to a pre-selected choir. It's not one of those choirs where anybody can say they want to sing. You choose. You choose the choir. But why do you need a choir when you've got these opinion leaders? Well, it's because all opinion leaders, or almost all, need to have a groundswell of informed public support. These influential people may be willing to sing along with you, but they need a chorus to reinforce their voices. So, who are the best choir members? This chart helps you to identify those you want to enlist in the choir. Good choir members may be found in your own organization. And Lois Hogan will talk to you about how you turn people into choir members within your own organization. Or you may be able to enlist those in the circle of your opinion leaders. In either case, when you're choosing your choir members, use your resources to focus upon those who are likely to be early adopters or late adopters. I tell you, trying to turn around the skeptics or the hardcore resistors is a waste of time and energy. But you know, sometimes we have a curious predilection as public relations professionals to spend our time trying to convert those that are unconvertible rather than empowering our own supporters. So we need to watch out for that. You may say, well, why not go directly to immediate acceptors? Aren't they the obvious ones? And the answer is, quite often not. Why? Because they may be zealots. And as we all know, or most of us have had experience, zealots on our side can do far more damage to our cause than those who are convinced resistors. What do zealots do? Well, they hit the wrong notes in the wrong time and in the wrong places. So we don't want to have to spend time undoing the well-meaning damage they've done. So this is, I think, to summary, what you do with your stakeholders. You go direct to them. You build relationships with the appropriate opinion leaders. And then you select the choir that will sing on the same page with you and those opinion leaders. And I tell you, these two actions are mightily effective with the ultimate decision makers. And so now I'm going to ask Roger to tell you how this actually works out in practice.
Thanks. While I'm miking up, handing up the first. If you wouldn't mind, the moderators. Yeah. You have. Okay. Can you hear me in the back? A little louder? Okay. Thank you very much. The case that I'm going to describe is modeled out. Applies to the models that Isabel described, involves Hancock Natural Resource Group. It's a subsidiary of John Hancock Financial Services. The Hancock Natural Resource Group buys, manages, and sells timberland for institutional investors. That involves about 3 million acres of forest land in North America and Australia, and about $4 billion in assets. In 1999, Hancock Natural Resource Group developed an innovative investment concept involving a controversial environmental issue at the center of global warming debate. I won't go into the technical details of the program, but I want to use this opportunity to communicate to tell you about the communication strategy we developed. Hancock needed to do two things: develop support among potentially vocal stakeholders, and also avoid public surprises that might negatively influence the behaviors of investors or policymakers. Now, we couldn't go to the general public with this communication strategy because the general public didn't have the behaviors that we needed. I mean, Hancock is, they might be the official sponsor of Major League Baseball, but the Diamondbacks and the Yankees and 50,000 fans aren't going to care about this. What we needed to do was go to the opinion leaders involved in global warming. And here, within this 8%, we needed to influence the behaviors of involved publics. And in this case, that involved U.S. Congress, the administration, national and international non-governmental organizations, countries in Europe and the Pacific Rim. The problem is that within this 8%, those opinion leaders are all debating amongst themselves the very issues with which Hancock was involved. I mean, this became a soup sandwich. We couldn't do anything with these opinion leaders, although we knew the players. So what we needed to do was super target among those opinion leaders and identify those who could give us the immediate behaviors we needed. And that's where preaching to the choir works, particularly when you're looking for behaviors. Now, we needed to identify early adopters. I'll concentrate on environmental organizations, those organizations who would likely understand and support Hancock's business model and would remain neutral at the time of any public announcement. And in this case, early adopters, through researching and through networking, we identified particular organizations that were opinion leaders that could give us those immediate behaviors. Those included Environmental Defense and the Nature Conservancy. So we devised a series of face-to-face meetings with these early adopters and Hancock to accomplish four things. First, to explain Hancock's business model on global warming. Second, learn from them their perceptions and objections, if any. Third, invite them to contribute to Hancock's environmental principles, which were at the core of this program. And fourth, ask them to work with their peers. Speak with their peers, their late adopters, and even the skeptics within the national and international environmental communities. The series of meetings occurred before international meetings concluded at The Hague and Amsterdam, and the results were very promising. The results of super targeting stakeholders in this particular model solidified relationships between Hancock and very important stakeholders on the issue. Also, the choir did the legwork. They gave us the immediate behaviors that we needed to bring this innovative investment model to the rest of the opinion leaders in global warming. And because those early adopters went to their peers, Hancock avoided resistance that might have occurred, that they might have triggered among some of the potential skeptics and resistors. So that's a brief case on how to apply both Leslie's paradigm and preaching to the choir. And at this stage, I'd like to take the next 10 minutes. We have 10 minutes? Good. In breakout, I'd like to take the next 10 minutes in breakout, talk amongst yourselves with the moderator, and ask this question. How would you identify and prioritize your stakeholders internally and externally in a situation you're currently facing?
Take this time to bring the tableless people, you know, pull your chairs up to a table, form a little circle in the middle.
How it works to go towards directly the stakeholders. And I've heard some conversations at some of the tables, and it was really interesting, so I know that you're enjoying that. And as usual with this group, we don't have to encourage you to talk, so that's great.
That's good.
Our next part is for desired behaviors in this process. We have Gail Winslow Pine, APR, and we're very proud that Gail was recognized today as in the new class of APRs at PRSA. Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Gail has been with Jackson Wagner about 5 years. She works with a lot of clients around the country. She has a great ability to get in there quickly, identify what the immediate needs are, and outline the strategic direction that we have to take. Gail works a lot on our crisis communications, crisis containment work, coalition building, community relations and working with senior executives. So, Gail Winslow-Pine.
Thanks, Pat. Can everybody hear me back there? Is that good? All right, good. Well, so far we've talked about the behavioral model as a whole, and we've just sort of had our first breakout group with a stakeholder discussion. And now we're going to talk about something that you heard probably Pat mention in the film today, Pat Jackson, about co-authoring behaviors. That is the behavior part of the behavioral model, the ultimate desired behaviors and those intermediate or preparatory behaviors. Well, what do we mean when we say ultimate desired behaviors? We mean those behaviors that you ultimately want your stakeholders to engage in. That is, you might want them to use your service or buy your product. What do we mean when we say preparatory or intermediate behaviors? Those are the behaviors that we want to lead stakeholders through to get to the ultimate desired behaviors. Okay, well, that's a bunch of language. What does it all mean, really? Well, it means just basically, even Stacy mentioned it before, I'm running for office, and what do I want you to do? The ultimate desired behavior I want from you is I want you to vote for me. I'm a nice person. Vote for me. How do I get you to vote for me? Well, first I need to lead you through some intermediate behaviors by way of triggering events. So that might mean that I want you to contribute to my campaign or take a phone call from one of my volunteers so you can learn about my platform. Or if you're a business, I might want you to put a sign up in your window that supports my campaign. That's what that really means. So what do these behaviors have in common? Well, these behaviors are finite and measurable. Softness or vagueness is out of the question. It's out of the equation. I talk about how this works in a case study. A few years back, USA Waste and Waste Management merged. And the new Waste Management came to us because they had been hearing from their current opinion leaders some feedback that there was concern among people that this new entity would renege on commitments made prior to the merger, possibly not honor contracts that had been made prior to this merger. They would become an uncontrolled monopoly with increased pricing, or they would cease to provide quality service that they had grown accustomed to. So at JJW, using a strategic planning session in which we actually, our planning session uses what we call the meat paper planning process, which if you've got your business card out and you're adding the little things to it, put meat paper right there, we'll know what it means. We actually talked about, first identified the stakeholder groups, and then using the behavioral strategy, we came up with what kind of behaviors we wanted to get from people. It really talks about four questions. Those four questions are, what are the ultimate desired behaviors that we want to motivate, reinforce, or modify to achieve our goals? That is, how do we want to identify our ultimate desired behaviors? Precisely which stakeholder groups can lead to these behaviors, or whose withholding or overt opposition could keep us from these goals? Meaning, we want to target our stakeholder groups. Since stakeholder groups don't typically act spontaneously, who are the opinion leaders to stimulate these stakeholder groups? That is, we want to connect with our opinion leaders. And since people don't typically go straight to the ultimate desired behavior from awareness, what intermediate behaviors might we lead them through as way stations? So in this case study, the ultimate desired behaviors that we came up with as we broke out the stakeholder groups, and we had about a dozen of them, and for this purpose, I'm just going to primarily clump up some of the political groups and business groups that we came up with. The ultimate desired behaviors that we wanted from these stakeholder groups was, one, we wanted them to demonstrate a confidence in Waste Management's ability to handle waste loads by not opposing landfill expansion permits. We wanted these stakeholder groups to view waste management as an important economic partner, and therefore we wanted them to be honored and recognized. And we wanted these groups to act as third-party advocates on behalf of waste management and actively engage in a two-way communication system that therefore acted as an issue anticipation or some kind of an early warning system down the road. These were the ultimate desired behaviors that we were going for. Okay, well, we knew we weren't going to get there right away, so how were we going to get them to there? Well, we came up with some intermediate behaviors through the use of some triggering events. First, we had waste management write some white papers on landfill and waste issues, and we got those out to these groups so that they could build their own awareness, and therefore they'd have some knowledge base to it. We engaged them in their opinion leader network systematically and formally by having one-on-one. Waste management went out and had one-on-one conversations with people, and then they were actually, those systems were recorded, and when there was something that they knew would come up, they were able to address it right away. We had waste management engage their speakers bureau. We had them out there proactively speaking at appropriate business organizations on a regular basis. And we also invited these groups to our physical sites for tours and informational gatherings so that they could see firsthand what were some of the issues and they could talk about them. Well, what were the end results? Very happily, businesses wrote letters on behalf of waste management when expansion permits came up in support of that and sent them off to their political leaders. Legislation was raised and landfill expansion permits were granted. And because these groups felt that the service had not diminished, they actually then did honor and award waste management with through chamber recognition and other business association awards. So now, using your stakeholder groups that you've talked about in your first roundtable, how would you identify your intermediate and ultimate behaviors that you want from these groups? And I believe we've got, well, Pat will let us know when we're going to break, so.
All right, we've got a few minutes. Remember, we still have to cover, and we really encourage you to stay with us, opinion leaders, organizational family, and localizing everything, which those three complete the picture of how you use the behavioral model. We've got about 10 minutes to go in this till we take a break at 3:45, and then we'll be starting back up on those three at 4 o'clock. So take a few minutes now, talk about the big question that we put up here, and then we'll move and take a break. And if you want to keep talking, you can keep talking. It's up to you, but we will let you know when it's 3:45. So continue talking. Our next presentation of starting with opinion leaders is going to be at 4 o'clock. So if you want to give your business cards now, we'll take them and give you your information.